This is the IBJ podcast for the week of November 27th, 2021, brought to you by First Person Advisors, a subsidiary of NFP. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. The pandemic has turned our lives upside down over the last 18 months and overturned a lot of conventional wisdom about our jobs and our workplaces. For example, employers and managers used to feel secure during downturns and periods of turmoil that their employees would be grateful to have jobs and would weather whatever it took to keep them. So what then are we to make of the Great Resignation, the term now in wide use for this tidal wave of departures we've seen this year? The term I like to use is quit storm, which I think adds a little flavor to the sense of desperation growing in human resources departments. Just take a look at the numbers. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, during the months of April, May, and June 2021, a total of 11.5 million workers quit their jobs. And a recent poll by Gallup found that 48% of employees are actively searching for new opportunities. These are foreboding figures for employers who have to shoulder the loss in productivity and then the cost of onboarding new employees. And that is all compounded by the scarcity of labor at the moment. Now, from the perspective of workers, I think it's fair to say that most of us have been under an extraordinary amount of stress in the last year and a half, and the changes to our routines and responsibilities contribute to burnout. Now, some people aren't comfortable anymore working in close quarters with fellow employees and customers. But some experts say that the Great Resignation also points to a more profound realization that we're fed up with the current state of American work culture, or that we need to take this opportunity to do something different that better aligns with our personal values. Now, to get a handle on the Great Resignation and how employers can avoid costly exits, I asked two columnists for IBJ's weekly In the Workplace feature to share what they've learned about this mass employment exodus and the significant changes required to retain workers going forward. You might recognize their names. It's Mandy Haskett and Garrett Mintz. I'll have more of them in a second. Here's our conversation. I'm pleased to welcome Mandy Haskett, a leadership consultant at Advisa, a Carmel-based leadership consultancy. Thank you for making time today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And we're joined by Garrett Mintz. He's the founder of Ambition in Motion, a firm that helps companies increase employee engagement and collaboration by implementing corporate mentor programs. Thanks for helping us out today.
Of course. Thanks for having me, Mason.
So maybe the first thing we need to do is understand why employees are quitting in greater numbers. How is this different from normal turnover? And Mandy, we'll start with you.
What's causing the Great Resignation? I think it's important that we put some historical context around this. First things first. So pre-COVID, for example, you know, talent was already in a long-term seller's market. In other words, we already had record low unemployment in Indiana. I think it was 3.6 or something like that before the pandemic hit. So there were more jobs than there were people to fill them before COVID came around the bend. And at the same time, we had this generational issue going on that economists were calling this cliff event. We have 10,000 baby boomers in our country turning 65 every single day. You know, by 2024, 41% of the US labor force is going to be over the age of 55. So we've got all these folks approaching, this is pre-pandemic, retirement age. And we have all these folks in middle management not quite ready to step up into leadership roles. So those of us, I think, who have been in this sort of people, culture, social science space have been beating this drum for 6 years saying, hey, guys, this is coming. Now's the time for organizations to shore up their talent. And then cue, you know, March 2020 and the pandemic hits, which, of course, creates this giant migration of human capital where all these organizations just lob off the bottom third of their workforce. And there's this expression, you know, that we've all heard, like, nobody leaves this ship during the hurricane. And I think for what we're seeing now often is not just this huge resurgence of, not resurgence, but I should say this surge of baby boomers who took an early retirement as a result of the pandemic hitting, but we're also seeing folks who are kind of high performers and in early career, middle career stages who maybe have been considering for a year and a half leaving their job because of burnout, because of the stress, because of all sorts of things that are going on in their workplace that Gallup has now called the Great Discontent. And as these waters recede, you know, and the hurricane sort of proverbially passes through, I think we're seeing folks jump ship.
Hey, you know, that's really interesting. I love the historical context on that, Mandy. I think that's really cool. And I appreciate you kind of bringing that in. I think that makes a ton of sense. I know from like a lot of our work. So one of the things that we do is we run these mastermind groups where we connect senior level leaders with other senior level leaders to help them gain objectivity and improve their performance. And one of the things that we kept seeing from a lot of senior level leaders is them taking sabbaticals, of them like literally stepping away and just taking 3 months off. Not even that they were moving to a new job. They were just saying like, hey, I'm going to take a sabbatical. And the sabbaticals weren't actually from CEOs, but they're typically from like COOs or chief revenue officers or VPs of whatever their role is. And I think a lot of it had to do with their relationship to their leader and ultimately the lack of clarity they had around what their next step would be and what their own, what they wanted the next step to be. I think a lot of them really struggled with this ambiguity around what am I moving to next? What am I doing? What do I want to accomplish in my life and my career? And I think the pandemic has caused people to really reevaluate those things. And even in senior level leadership roles, saying like, you know what? There's a lot of things that are stressful. Right now, I'm taking on a lot of work, a lot of hours because I'm in this senior role and I'm making obviously this certain salary and all these sort of things. I don't necessarily know if I want that. Like, I don't know if this is sustainable for me in this role. And it's really fascinating as people, you know, garner that. And really what I'm so fascinated by is the conversations between that person and their manager and how they can be on the same page moving forward. And if they can't, that's where we see a lot of that turnover happening, at least on like a senior level basis.
Yeah. But if I ask my boss for a 3 month sabbatical, she's going to laugh for about 20 minutes and then she's going to tell me to get back to work. I mean, the people who don't have that ability or that kind of clout, their path, I think in their minds might be, well, it's just time for me to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's a trend. It is a grass is greener kind of a job market right now. So, you know, where I might have had two or three opportunities that I could have gone and sought out if I felt really at odds with the work that I was doing, now I have a dozen or more. So as these choices continue to proliferate, I think this is really where I think the work that Garrett and I both do comes to benefit the world at large. Is organizations have to be able to create these magnetic cultures, these destinations where that draw people to them and make people then want to stay. And that takes quite a bit of intention and effort. And to Garrett's point, it takes good leadership. And that is really the crux of it all. The manager, the leader, we say managers are the window through which people experience their organization. Certainly, you know, you don't quit your job, you quit your boss is still very, very true. Folks are leaving their leader. They're leaving their boss just as much as they're leaving their job, we're finding as well.
Well, that's so true. It's interesting. I think Gallup came out with the research that showed that 70% of all employee engagement variance depends on the relationship between that person and their manager. So that relationship is so vital. One of the things my team and I have been researching is we've been working on this tool essentially to help essentially leverage employee feedback to improve manager and leader performance and helping managers and leaders get a better pulse on their people and what's going on with how they're feeling at work. And then how they can more or less be a coach, not just a manager, but a coach to their people within the role itself. One of the things that we measure is this metric called organizational citizenship, which essentially is a measure of anything that you do that you're not asked to do at work. So this could mean helping out somebody else on a project or bringing in coffee for the team or just general selfless behaviors. And the reason why it's such an interesting metric is because most teams don't measure this. And this is the meat of culture. Like when I feel like I'm in an embracing culture, it's how does not the CEO treat me, but everybody else at the organization treat me in terms of their selflessness, their willingness to help me out, their desire and drive to help me out. And when we don't measure these sorts of things, it's easy for people to be selfish and say, hey, I'm just going to focus on my task performance and the things that I need to get done, because I know that if I can hit these sales numbers or push this much code, I'm much more likely to get promoted into this management position. If we can look at other factors like org citizenship, we can really get a better pulse as to who might be a better leader, who might be the right person to promote.
Garrett, in your conversations with leaders and higher up managers, are they cognizant of the fact that they could be partially to blame for people leaving the organization?
Well, that's where the data comes in. Like, that's where this tool we've been working on, we call it the AIM Insights tool. Essentially, it's so powerful to show them their own people's data. Is like, this is what they think about your manager performance. Like, this is what they think about you. So often, we will meet with leaders that are unaware of the things that are going on. Like, I'll hear things like, oh, I only have a 5-person team, or I've got a 6-person team. I know my people like the back of my hand. We meet every single day. And then you learn about the biggest challenge of like every single one of your direct reports. It's like lack of communication. You're like, really? Whoa, I didn't realize Sharon was feeling that way. Whoa, like, let me do a reevaluation as to maybe how I'm communicating. Because so often we think the fact that we're doing it means that the other person's satisfied. But what we're not realizing is that there's personality differences between our communication style and our direct reports' communication style. But because we are in a hierarchical scenario, I'm above that person, their likelihood of challenging me or pushing back is diminished, because they don't want to get fired. They don't want to lose face. It's that lack of objectivity we get as leaders from our team when we're higher than them that causes that disconnect between, wow, I thought you were happy, and all of a sudden you just left.
Now, from a demographic standpoint, I mean, is there one generation or one group that we've called a generation, like X or Y or Z, who is more likely to leave? Or are we seeing this really across the board?
Across the board. I mean, yeah, with our mastermind groups, we've seen this happen with, you know, 50 plus year old CEOs to Gen X in their 40s to millennials in their, you know, 20s and 30s. And obviously even Gen Z, like starting out their careers. It's interesting, especially for the older demographics, at least, it's a lot of an evaluation of like, what do I really want in life? Where am I? And why am I doing this? Like, where is this taking me? Where am I going? Why do I do what I'm doing? And how is this serving me?
And Mandy, are we seeing this also across industries?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think, you know, really employees between 30 and 45 years old tend to have the greatest increase in resignation rates right now. Although, to Garrett's point, we are still seeing it across the board. I think that mid-career high potential is really the one to laser focus on inside of organizations. And to the extent that they have maybe no career path, or there's a mismatch between personal values and the mission or the values of the organization that they're trying to serve, and maybe also that they have a desire or a need for flexibility, that's not just possible with the current employer. Those are really the three big things that we're seeing. And those are pretty industry agnostic. I mean, I would argue that if humans work there, it is not off the table, right? No industry is safe from this great resignation. However, healthcare and technology, tech and healthcare tend to be the two that we're really seeing the most migration happen in. I think that there will be more industry that bubbles up as a result of just the extreme burden that the pandemic itself placed on certain industries like hospitality, right? Where people are just by nature burned out from having to really grind to keep the lights on. I think all industries are certainly subject to see this type of migration.
Okay, let's take a quick break to hear from our sponsor. This is the IBJ Podcast.
What will take you and your people to the stratosphere? News, learning ops, and insights from the benefits, compensation, and people experts at First Person Advisors, now a subsidiary of NFP. Subscribe to The Boost for weekly updates at firstpersonadvisors.com/boost.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast, and I'm talking with guests Mandy Haskett and Garrett Mintz about the reasons behind the Great Resignation and how companies can retain their workers.
I want to make sure we, with our remaining time, we answer the $64,000 question of how employers can head off resignations, or even just one really important resignation. And I'm going to start very quickly by saying the one thing that I'm sure that you should not do, that is call an all hands on deck meeting for the company, say, hey, I get that the last 18 months have been really difficult, but we really appreciate all the work you're doing. And if you have any trouble, come see me. I'm going to guess that is not the ultimate solution.
Anybody? No, I would say that is definitely not the solution.
As it pertains to what we can do as leaders to essentially not have people burn out, I think what's really critical is that we equip our managers, back to this whole point of people don't quit their jobs, they quit their boss. I think if we need to do more as leaders to equip our mid-level managers to be coaches. I mean, I think that's it. I think that, I mean, at the end of the day, what can we do to empower our people to be happy, satisfied, and engaged at work? So often, a lot of times we'll essentially have people in management role where they also have individual responsibilities as well. And there's a lot of ambiguity as to what the priority list is. Like, do I lead my people or do I focus more on my individual responsibilities? And I think for most companies, our focus has been like, do your individual responsibilities and then like lead your people if you can. I think the really critical component is it should be flipped. I think it should be more about coaching. And as leadership, we should be more lenient to our managers if they're not able to get their individual tasks done, if they're really doing a great job coaching their direct reports. Because ultimately, if they're leading 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 people, and those people are working optimally and are doing really great work, that's awesome. That's way more productive than the one really high performing individual manager could do on their own. And so if we can change the focus from trying to be more focused on our middle managers, focus on their individual tasks and helping them be more focused on being a coach, a leader, a person who's driving the growth of their people, not just because they can hit organizational metrics. Like oftentimes we'll see a lot of companies be very clear about their org metrics of what do we need to hit as a company over this next quarter, but really specific on the individuals. What does John or Jane Doe want to accomplish in the next 3 months for them personally, for where they want to go with their life? And is that in sync with where the organization's goals are? Can we align that? That's so critical as a manager. If you can do that, you can keep your people engaged. You can keep them excited about work. They're going to stay because they're ultimately realizing that their personal aspirations align with the organization's aspirations. They work hand in hand together. And at minimum, they should be talking about it. But this whole, you know, annual performance review is when we give each other feedback thing. That's out the window. That really shouldn't be in existence. And really, we should be chatting on a monthly basis, at least one-on-one, to know what's going on with you, me as being the manager to a direct report, versus delaying that or prolonging those types of intentional, challenging directly and caring personally conversations.
I would just layer onto that. I think that that line of sight to the organization is critical. I need to understand how me turning this wrench all day long gets the organization where they need to go. How do we meet our strategic aims with me just doing this job every single day? That is critical. I would say three more things that come to mind that all leaders really need to be laser focused on as we all move to kind of rekindle productivity, because that's still important. As we migrate through this bizarre pre-post-pandemic hybrid, non-hybrid remote workforce moment is job fit. So when our organizations reduced their workforces largely in 2020, they got rid of people, but they didn't get rid of the work, right? The work still had to go somewhere. So about a third of the work has now floated or matriculated up to the remaining humans in the organization, and their jobs changed. And at the end of the day, if I have to come into my job and I've got to pick up this big old anchor and who I am and I've got to move it, I got to turn myself inside out to do my work. I can do that. That's a choice. But it takes energy for me. It's going to make me tired over time. It's going to make me resentful over time. And it's also going to drive my engagement and therefore my productivity down. So reassessing, and this is where the data-driven piece comes in too. I think the data is so critical. Leaders who are leading and who understand how to leverage people data and people science to be able to make predictions about things like job fit, about connection to strategic aims and alignment, those folks really do have a competitive advantage, I believe, over their counterparts who are just guessing. That job fit is critical. If you put me in a job that meets my inherent motivating needs as a human, I'm going to perform much, much better at a much higher level. And I'm, of course, going to be more engaged. Second is teams. with our remote and hybrid workforce or move to that in 2020, a little bit of 2021, we're still in it. I think opportunities to collaborate have to be so much more intentional. You know, me sharing that I got a new car over the weekend and my kid's covered head to toe in poison ivy and yours is graduating from college or whatever those kind of little throwaway comments are that we have together as a community to help us build trust and shared purpose as teams don't typically rise to the level of importance in a Zoom meeting that is scheduled for 1 hour every other week. So leaders who understand that they need to be intentional about creating trust and shared purpose with their teams, giving their teams opportunities to collaborate as we migrate through this strange time, I believe those folks are also, we're seeing in our data, much more engaged, much more productive, and they're staying too inside of organizations. And the third thing that I'd say is just culture. And by culture, what I mean is values alignment. Is the organization clear on their values? And more specifically, are they clear on what the specific behaviors are that roll up to the values? If leaders are culture carriers, right, they're picking up this culture like a briefcase every day and they're carrying it around. They're living out these behaviors and they're doing it so that folks understand this is okay here and this is not. This is okay. This is rewarded here and celebrated and this is not. And that helps individuals have autonomy. It helps empower people to make decisions when they're on their own and reaffirm their alignment with the organization. Oh, yep, those still are my values. And I think that too is just a huge driver of retention that we're seeing.
One of the things that I consistently hear, and I mean, something that we talk about at our work, is now that we've been working or have been working remotely for more than a year, everybody now has evidence that they can do their jobs remotely and everything, you know, more or less is fine. And if management is pressing people to come back, that is going to push people away.
I mean, I think it just depends on the company and the individual and the organization itself. You know, it's kind of crazy. I had like my first in-person meeting in like a long time yesterday morning. And I was realizing how much time I was spending between like trips, like to get there and to come back. Like that was not really the most effective use of my time. I mean, I don't know if I'm having conversation, if I'm doing, let's say, outbound sales conversations or conversations with clients to make sure they're doing okay or having technical meetings. Like if I'm physically having to do them in person, it's a whole lot less efficient, especially if we're talking about commute time, than to do it remotely. However, we do know that every team is different. Every scenario is different. It's unique. I think what's probably most critical in all of this is that we're able to build connection between people. I think if we are going to work remotely, we've got to be able to have that connection there. Whether that means we're in, I mean, obviously, you know, I'll promote mentorship for sure, but even just cross connectivity between departments so then people know what they're doing, the struggles that they're going through. Just because ultimately, when we are remote, we lose empathy. When we don't, when we're not around people, we lose empathy for what they're going through. When we start to build our own paradigm and not our narrative in our minds about what other people are doing, especially if they're not getting their things done. And it's even evidence, like, what, you know, with that tool that I was mentioning before, we measure this thing called team productivity and task performance. And what we're seeing in a lot of the remote teams we're working with, they put themselves individually as high task performance, but low team productivity, meaning they think everybody else is slacking, but I'm kicking butt and taking names. That is a recipe for culture to fall apart, because ultimately that is the type of scenario that could ultimately lead to a culture unraveling and not doing so great.
What do we do about employees who are burnout, who feel burnout? I mean, that's a difficult thing to alleviate. I mean, are they too far gone at that point? Or are there ways to bring them back?
I think it just determines what drives them. So in our mentorship research, we found that some people are job oriented, some people are career oriented, and some people are calling oriented. And it's a spectrum. It changes throughout your life. So people who are job oriented are motivated by work-life balance. People who are career oriented are motivated by professional growth, and people who are calling oriented are motivated by impact, and they're aligning their impact personally with the organization's impact. And it changes. It's constantly fluid and it's a spectrum. But what we learned was when two people's work orientations are aligned at any given moment in time, they're substantially more likely to get along with each other in a mentor relationship. But extrapolating that to a management perspective, if as I, as a manager, am trying to provide motivation or inspiration or carrots that I would be motivated by, but aren't driving my people, I potentially am risking burning them out. So if I'm career oriented and all of my motivational tactics are around getting promotions or more responsibilities, but you're job oriented, that doesn't align with you. If it's like, hey, they keep asking me to do more and more hours, but I want some more work-life balance, that is not going to drive me. That's going to cause me to feel like there's a disconnect between what I want and what this company wants from me. And ultimately, that's going to drive my burnout even more.
I think the spirit of what you're really saying there has to do with getting our needs met. We all have to get our needs met. We're animals at the end of the day. And we'll all behave in ways to get our needs met and make sure that that's the case. When our needs are met in life and work, our confidence goes up, and confidence and productivity are linked in social science. We can't be very productive without any confidence. So getting those needs met is critical, and leaders have to have some good objective data oftentimes to understand what those different needs might be, because we can't just lead others the way we want to be led. The golden rule doesn't work at work. I need to understand objectively, you know, Mason, what you need so that as a leader, I can make choices as to how to better engage you. Burnout specifically, there's been a lot of interesting research about in the last 5 or so years, and PET scans over the last decade have revealed to us that we are in fact feeling creatures who occasionally think. We are emotional beings. And burnout is really linked to feelings. It's linked to emotions. It's linked to chronic emotion that we get stuck in. Emotions and feelings like stress. So in times like 2020, April, May, we all remember those days when we were quarantined and there was a great amount of unknown. We're waking up every day to these chronic repeated feelings that we're stuck in. And when we get stuck in a feeling or an emotion of any kind, that's when fatigue, that's when exhaustion occurs in human brains. And over time, that's what leads to burnout. So in our work in developing leaders' emotional intelligence, oftentimes that's the key to combating burnout, is being able to be aware. Emotional intelligence is all about, I am aware that there are emotions present here. And now that I am aware of that, I have skills or tools to be able to still connect in a meaningful way with this person when emotions are present. So I need some data to know, hey, how high is my empathy? How high is my stress tolerance? What about my impulse control? Right? When I can get a good read on those things, and EQ is not hardwired, it's softwired. In other words, we can make more, we can build more. If my empathy is low, good news. I know what to do. I can make more. There are skills, there are tools. And when that's the case, especially I think we saw these derailers in EQ, these derailing competencies for leaders last year, be things like stress tolerance and things like impulse control and things like empathy in particular. You know, if those things aren't high in leaders, well, then of course, when emotions are present, we get stuck and we get fatigued. And over time, we get burned out because we're people.
You know, there's a something else that just kind of sparked in my head about like psychological safety. You know, when you're going through a period like we've been through where you are constantly afraid that the company is in trouble and, you know, they're just looking for people to fire. How do you convince your employer or your employees that they're not on the chopping block? How do you make them feel safe at work?
You talk to them. So you can't convince anybody that they're not on the chopping block, right? Because they might be very well may be. I think empathy, transparency, clarity. Those are the three things that come to mind. ETC. So the more you can empathize, hey, I know this is a really confusing and scary time for all of us, and we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. The more you can be transparent and clear in your communication, here is all the information that we know, and provide clarity to the specific concern that they have, that's the best that we can do as leaders. You know, transparency is the currency of leadership, as they say. I think those three things do amount to a great deal in giving people some degree of psychological safety. And the reason why is because when folks don't get enough information, they fill in the holes. We all do this. They fill in the gaps with the worst case scenario. We all do that. So give them as much as you can. Communicate early, communicate often. When you feel like you've done it enough, do it more, especially in times of transition and concern.
It's funny. I was just thinking about, the number of closed door meetings that, we see in the office, which I'm sure is completely appropriate. But every time somebody sees a closed door meeting in the office, they start skulking around asking other people, why is that door closed? And yeah, I think you're right. You really do fill in, the blank. Well, who's that person in that room? What does that mean to me?
Absolutely. Yeah. Our brains are problem solving machines, right? When they don't have a problem to solve, they'll create one.
That's the truth. I have a quick question about people who are just dead set on going. Is there a right way to leave?
Oh, dead set on leaving their job?
Yeah. I mean, everybody I'm sure has at some point during the day, usually at 3 o'clock, where they're like, I'm so frustrated. I want to quit. Now, most of us don't quit at that moment, but there are better ways, than quitting in rage or quitting in frustration. What should you need to make sure that you do on your way out the door?
So my thought here is that this is actually a longer game than on your way out the door. Hopefully, if you're feeling as though you're no longer connected to your work and you're ready to become a part of the great resignation and jump off of that ship now that the hurricane has somewhat past us, well, then I think you ought to start thinking about, what can I do to exhaust my opportunities here? What conversations have I proactively had with my leader to express my unhappiness here, or whatever that might be? Hey, I no longer feel like this is the job that I signed up for. And these elements and aspects of my work are just draining me to no end. I don't have any energy left when I have to do these parts of my job. It's a manager's responsibility to be able to coach these people in using their whole selves at work. So if a leader absolutely cannot remove or rearrange the elements or aspects of that job that meet that individual, potentially high performer's needs, then that would be a sign that it would be a time to move on. I would also be evaluating, does this organization no longer provide me the flexibility that I need? And have I had that conversation? Hey, I need to be working from home 2 days a week because I've got to get my kids off of the bus. Aftercare is not an option for us because there are capacity issues and, the pandemic is still here. See if your leader will allow that. Don't just quit, have these conversations. I think the third part is a mix match between potentially values that have evolved. And Garrett mentioned this earlier, in more senior leaders, we're seeing more esoteric ideas about legacy evolve. What am I doing here? What is my purpose? I never wanted to be a CFO in the first place, and I'm 62 and I got to figure out a new pathway. But that mismatch or that misalignment between my values have evolved as a human, and therefore, potentially, the values of the organization no longer align with mine. I think that's an opportunity to have those conversations, because most of the time, I think leaders would love to save their people, and they'll do a lot of work to get them to stay. And they might just be lacking the good data that more progressive organizations proactively gather to head off those conversations. Instead, they have to have them reactively, but it's better to at least begin there, I believe, before you rip off the Band-Aid and leave in a huff.
Yeah, I love that point, Mandy. I think that's really interesting. I think a lot of times we assume that our leader knows the challenges that are going on, or is also conscientiously aware of what the standards are across other orgs and industries. And oftentimes, a lot of times, leaders are just oblivious. I mean, the reason why these mastermind groups exist is because a lot of times leaders recognize, like, there's things that are going on that I'm realizing I need to probably know more about. And it's helpful to connect with other leaders who might be going through something similar and just be able to relate and chat about that.
Well, hey, this has been fantastic. I already feel like I need to listen to this again and figure out but what I need to do as a manager and as an employee. Thank you so much for sharing your time and your wisdom with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
My thanks again to Mandy Haskett and Garrett Mintz. You can find their columns on workplace issues at ibj.com. And Mandy's latest on the new emphasis on people strategy in corporate America is in the current issue of the IBJ. And speaking of the current issue, there are a few other stories I want to bring to your attention. First up, Jim Irsay wants to share his massive collection of rare pop culture memorabilia with the world. Vicky Shuey reports that the Colts owner has been having early conversations with Indianapolis and other cities about creating a museum to do just that. Also in this week's issue, Susan Orr reveals that an Indianapolis-based investment brokerage has been ordered to pay more than $530,000 in fines and restitution as part of a settlement agreement over alleged rule violations. And Kirk Christian details a plan from Bedrock Builders for a 142,274-acre master-planned multi-use development smack in the middle of Noblesville's corporate campus. Again, you can find these stories in the latest edition of IBJ or online at ibj.com. I will say, as I do, it's quite a bit easier to access all of the latest local news about business and politics and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to ibj.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.